You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Next, we have a piece from Dr. James Wenley, who was actually my old drama lecturer. And so we had a good catch up after I told him that I actually dropped out being a drama major after I took his course. I lasted 1 week in stage two drama, so he taught me for drama 100. Louis just laughing at me there. Yeah.
Hey, you gave it your best.
I did give it my best shot. So James is now currently a lecturer at Vic University in Wellington. And with his show, Dr. Drama Makes a Show, he hopes to stir up conversations around performance, masculinity, whiteness, and Pākehā privilege. We speak about what it means to be a supportive ally and white male fragility. According to James, uncomfortable questions are thrown up around the 250th anniversary of Captain Cook's arrival and non-Māori protesters, or Wairaka, are claiming mana whenua status and that Pākehā seem to be going through a renewed identity crisis. It's an uncomfortable and difficult conversation, I think, but necessary. So I begin by asking James what he means by calling his show a post-dramatic meta-theatrical lecture performance solo.
Do you know what post-dramatic is, Sherry?
Oh, no.
I put you on the spot there.
Did we learn about this in Drama 100? Post-dramatic, that's after-dramatic.
Yeah.
And is it like postmodernism?
It's very much tied up with postmodernism. We are learning some things today.
Oh, yeah, this is a learning
so
opportunity for everyone.
There is traditional drama, which you know, if you go see a play, you might expect there's going to be some characters, there's going to be a really clear plot, and you kind of understand what happens in the plot based on character motivations and all the events that happen, and that's a really kind of fulfilling, straightforward style of storytelling. But then kind of postmodernism comes in and we kind of get a little bit bored with that, and so post-dramatic is all about kind of ripping up those conventions, and it's less interested in trying to represent the real world, which is kind of what drama has been involved in, especially through like the 18th and 19th centuries into the 20th century. And so being at post-dramatic, we kind of throw out plot. I'm playing myself or different personas of myself. So I am James Wenley, and we're getting rid of the fourth wall between the actor and the audience, where I pretend that you're not there and you pretend that I'm not there. We're very much in the same space, and it's going to have quite a number of different modes of performance, so it never kind of stays the same, that it's always shifting into different places, and rather than kind of being structured by here's one thing that happens, here's the next thing, it's kind of revolving around the themes that I'm playing with.
What about the meta-theatrical bit of that?
So that's tied into it. And because I am a lecturer, I'm Dr. Drama, I study performance and teach it, I'm not going to just do a kind of a straightforward show. So I am having this kind of running commentary discussing what I am doing in the show. It's kind of some live dramaturgical analysis, okay, where we're looking at how it's been constructed and the different choices that have been put into it. So hopefully that's kind of interesting, but there's also a deeper layer to that, that if I criticize it first, which is kind of what this does, it kind of preempts criticism that other people might give to me. So there's kind of a defensiveness that I'm also interested in exploring and actually using that device.
Because I know that you also are a theatre critic on the side as well. So how do you think that role and that identity has shaped or disrupted the way you've approached this piece?
I guess if we were kind of to step back, when I was a student and kind of studying drama, I started off really loving acting, but then I moved behind the scenes, really liked being director, writer, and how a whole show can kind of be put together. And then I found that I could write as a critic quite well, and that I was sort of needed in a way. I run this website called Theatre Scenes. I also reviewed for Metro magazine for a while. And so I kind of started to see that this is my act of service for the industry. This is something that I kind of need to do, and I can make a contribution towards it. But also there's a kind of tension there between being a critic and also being a practitioner or an artist maker. And so this, in a weird way, is a chance to kind of bring those together, in that I am performing, but I'm also the first critic of my performance as well,
yeah,
in a really weird way.
It's a discomfort that I'm very intrigued by. Yeah, because I mean, what do you think criticism? How do you think criticism plays a role in performance and in storytelling?
Yeah, so there's some kind of descriptions that criticism is like parasitic, like you've got the person who makes the art and you've got this kind of person from above to kind of swoop in and make the judgment of it, which kind of has been the sort of the traditional form of critic that, you know, this the great kind of genius that sees all the stuff. And for me, I kind of always have to kind of constantly interrogate that, and what is the place that I'm writing from, and am I the appropriate person to review a particular show? And for me, criticism, or good criticism, it's actually just unpacking the choices that has been made in terms of someone making a work, and what were some of the implications or meanings that you kind of found in that. So they could have made other choices, they made these choices, so it's really kind of engaging that and then translating that, the live experience, into a written review if that's what you're doing. And my kind of hope is that people then reading the review can use that to clarify their own response to a show, whether they agree with a reviewer or totally disagree. It's a way to kind of really heighten their own engagement with a show by comparing it to what someone else has expressed. And I think that's the beautiful thing about theatre and art and performance, is that you have all of the different subjective perspectives that you can take. And it's so interesting to hear how other people saw the same thing that you did.
Yeah. I want to ask more about, understand more about the perspective that you're wanting to unpack with this show, which you said is like a privilege being a white cis male. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really, I think white people are not very good at talking about their privilege. So how has that conversation been?
Yes, I'm hoping to be able to raise a lot of questions through the show in a way by putting myself up as the text to study, which I also feel quite uncomfortable about, because there's the whole thing of if I'm centering my voice, what does that mean as well? And there's a real kind of tension there. But it's how do you open that space, and what is my responsibility as a Pākehā man in terms of engaging with this really important conversation? So that was definitely something I was really conscious of in terms of making the show, especially as someone who has kind of written quite a lot with the platform that I have as an arts commentator about what the industry is doing and the need to have better representation and inclusivity and all that in terms of the art that's being made and the art that we have access to as audiences. Mm-hmm. So that was all kind of very present, and the work I kind of start off, this, if we call him a character, James Wenley starts off quite confident that he's an expert and comfortable talking about the subjects of performance, masculinity, whiteness, and my own identity. But as it goes on, there's a lot more kind of doubt as you kind of go into the complexities and the uncertainty about, yeah, how to do this conversation and how to apply the theory.
Because as someone who is Tauiwi, so not Pākehā, obviously that's a very different space, and I'll approach these dynamics differently. But what needs to be talked about in regards to that discomfort and the power and the privilege that Pākehā hold in Ngā Tauira?
Well, I think that's quite key, that it is really important to be ready to be uncomfortable, to be ready to listen. And I guess it's the kind of, if you've got the wider societal pressure, which is all about, you know, let's kind of ignore the kind of uncomfortable stuff, ignore the statistics around different socioeconomic groups and outcomes. And so you really kind of try to shut down that conversation, because it is big once you start to unopen it. It's the Pandora's box, and there's not necessarily a clear pathway as to, there's no kind of perfect way of, okay, what do you kind of do with that information? So it's being very present And one of the kind of the ideas in the show is that it's really important to really understand and examine what that white or Pākehā identity is, and how does that influence the way that you move through the world. I think it's really easy, because society's structured that way, for white people to kind of forget that and not question what that means to be white or to be Pākehā, because we're not constantly kind of having those messages that you don't belong, that you don't fit in. And so you kind of get into that sense of comfort. And so that is what I hope to raise in my own way with my story through this show.
Because one thing I noticed growing up was, it was always very frustrating when my white friends would say, oh, white people have no culture, Pākehā, you know, there's no culture, we're so boring. But the thing is, you know, from a young age, there is a culture there, it's just because it's the norm. And as someone who is the other, I've had to learn to fit in and do all these things to fit into the culture that I guess many Pākehā people are blind to. For me, are sometimes strange things that they do. When you're from that group, you don't see it as strange, you see it as norm and not the other. So, yeah, is that something that will be talked about in your show?
It's definitely in there. I think what you kind of raise about, Pākehā, people feeling like they don't have a culture, I mean, it's just so right. It's everywhere. That is the culture. And I think it is about finding the things to celebrate in that culture. What is the kind of the positive stuff about that? But also, if you're doing that, you also have to really look at what are the problematic stuff. You can celebrate, but you also really have to interrogate and be comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah, because especially recently, with Auckland University and perhaps some other institutions, we've got the rise of white supremacy and the rise of the alt-right, which is often linked to European or white organisations. So with white supremacy and white people currently having a lot of power and a lot of privilege, how do you have those conversations? So where is the onus in terms of educating yourself? You know, is that onus on people of colour or people of minorities to have conversations with the dominant group, or is there an onus on the dominant groups to make sure that they're not being racist shits? I don't know how to phrase it.
I mean, that's exactly right. So I guess that is the kind of the question of who's doing the cultural labour. And yeah, it's something that a lot of ethnic minorities in Aotearoa are engaged with, because they see it all the time. But Pākehā is less willing sometimes to kind of have that conversation. And so for me, part of this is that I would love to be able to talk to other Pākehā people through this show. And that's important to have that conversation. But equally, I want to be able to raise up voices that aren't my own, that are different to me, because it is a discourse, and it is also, who are you listening to? Who are the people that you are reading? That if you're just consuming cultural products that are from a very similar perspective to your own, you're going to have such a narrow worldview. And so, I mean, that's one of the things that I love about theatre as the artistic medium, is that there is so many different perspectives to engage with. And the Auckland Fringe coming up is really exciting, because there's so much, a smorgasbord of really interesting work out there. And so I think that's a really good place to start as Pākehā, is, what are the voices that you are listening to, and can you widen that?
And I want to zero in specifically on, I guess, theatre and the creative arts, because like a few years back, there was a Shakespeare company.
That's right.
That was Pop Up Globe, under fire for having all male casts. And I guess a lot of, if we look at the percentages of male to female ratio of directors or choreographers or those in decision making positions as well, is also predominantly male. What conversations do you think need to be had about privilege in terms of theatre?
That's a really key one, and something that I think there has been a growing consciousness around in theatre. it's most obvious on stage, right? Because those are the people that you are seeing. But it's structurally behind that. Who are the people that have the power in the rehearsal room, in the organisations? And so that, I think, is something that we need to continually be looking at, is who is being invited, who has the power. And, you know, there's the we throw around diversity as the goal to achieve, which is, that's part of it. But just kind of having a wider diversity of people, say, acting, isn't necessarily fundamentally kind of changing the power structures behind that. My sort of idealistic view is that theatre is the should be the place where we are leading, that we should be further ahead of society, because we are presenting an image back to society of who we can be, of who we want to be. And that gets me really excited, but also quite cynical sometimes when you see that progress is really slow. And the kind of the secondary problem with that is the level of income that's kind of available in the arts. And to kind of really have that revolution, we need to also have way better funding for huge different groups of people making work for audiences.
No, for sure, because I think the ability to have that as your source of income is such a privilege. Theatre's supposed to represent, it should represent diversity and people from all across demographics, but it's really hard to have a stable form of income from theatre. So that means what kind of people are able to be able to do that?
It's the real problem of who can afford it and who can afford to keep going. That's the kind of the heartbreaking thing when people drop out that have so much to offer because there wasn't a kind of a sustainable pathway financially.
I guess coming from a dominant group, how do you be the best ally to minority communities?
Yes, so this is a really kind of present question for me in terms of how I use my voice. And I have written on areas that are kind of outside my own identity in terms of the representation of gender on stage or culture. And my voice is listened to, and that's kind of part of what the show is responding to, is I think I have been listened to because I am the Pākehā man who has studied. And I find that really interesting. And so there is a responsibility to speak out, but you also have to balance that with listening and amplifying other voices, other speakers. And so that real allyship is being able to give over that space. And I can't give much away in this interview, but there's an experiment within the show as to, is there a way for me to do that within the context of me doing a selfish solo show? Yeah, this is something that I think about a lot, and I don't think I always get it right myself in terms of being the loud, educated voice.
It's difficult because it's important to be an ally. Things such as white guilt or feeling guilty about things isn't going to change the problem, and it isn't going to fix it, right? So it's not going, oh, woe is me, I've got so many privileges, fuck, that's hard. It's also using it.
Yes. Yeah. So you've got to be aware of those privileges. It's not taking for granted what you have been given based on kind of history, right? But yes, and so acknowledging that, what then are you going to do with that privilege, and how can you raise up other people? And not in a kind of condescending, I know best way. It's about being ready to admit that you don't know. And if so, then how do you kind of keep that education going?
Yeah, because I think it's really, really topical, because I wrote down here recently the Bob Jones stuff.
Oh my gosh, Bob Jones.
And so, you know, in that instance, we've got someone who, has an immense privilege.
We can say that Bob Jones is a racist.
Yeah. For sure. But yeah, you've got people of immense power, and being able to take a hate to course, saying that it's defamatory, being called out for being a racist, like.
But the other thing I think that's really good to remember is that, you know, racist is that, ooh, you know, big word. But you've kind of got the overt sort of nature of that. But it's all of those kind of smaller things, the things that you do unconsciously. And, you know, that is because of how society's kind of embedded all of these kind of messages in the media that you've kind of grown up watching, that it's all kind of in there. And so it's a continual process of awareness, and you're not kind of suddenly not racist, you know. It's easy to say I'm not racist, but actually it's harder to say I've got these things that are still kind of unconscious biases or conscious bias.
Yeah.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.